It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember. I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here! Tonight, let us make them remember. We are not afraid!
No fear, no fear, no fear, no fear here on Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, here in Phoenix, Arizona, from the BEA Beautiful Studios of Freedoms with an S, freedomsphoenix.com. We got a special bonus show for you today. This is going to be an interesting conversation. We're going to try and go without too many breaks. Just go right straight through it and have us a good old time. Now, who I have on, Robert Mazur. Now, Robert Mazur is the author of The Infiltrator, My Secret Life. Inside the dirty banks behind Pablo Escobar's Medellin cartel. Well, is there a bank that isn't dirty when it comes to this drug war stuff? Well, that's one thing I'm going to ask right off the bat. Robert, tell me, are there good banks, in your opinion, that don't break the money laundering laws, or any of those left?
Well, yeah, I think we need to categorize banks in kind of two different segments. When we speak about banks, I'm not going to be talking about your community bank where down the street you have a savings account and a checking account. I really do believe that within that community of banks, that there's a vigorous anti-money laundering compliance program and Bank Secrecy Act compliance. People reporting transactions they're supposed to, and people doing due diligence to make sure they're not dealing with the wrong kind of people. But on the other hand, when we turn to the international banking community, and when I say international banking community, I don't mean necessarily that it has to be a bank that's based outside the United States. We certainly have many international banks that are based in the United States, in Citibank, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, and it goes on and on. But that also includes other banks outside the United States that are very often involved in cross-border transactions. And with respect to those that are involved in cross-border transactions, I'm afraid to say that at least it's been my experience that there's been a good number of them that have established marketing plans to assist extraordinarily wealthy individuals. These may be people involved in income tax evasion, customs duty evasion. It could be money launderers, drug traffickers, arms dealers. It could be people who are pilfering treasuries, like in Libya, where the Gaddafi family probably has pilfered quite a bit. It could be individuals who want to deal with our enemies. It could be people who want to deal with Iran and other enemy governments that are prohibited by law for us to deal with. There is a segment of the international banking community that offers services to people who want to break those laws. There's no doubt about it. There's a body of cases that have come forth in the last 4 or 5 years that case after case after case demonstrate a systemic activity within the bank to provide services to people like that. We can look at, and I'll just run through a bunch of them, and you can pick anyone you want to get into the particulars about. But in March of 2010, last year, Wachovia Bank admitted criminal offense in connection with their activities. We have Bank Atlantic in 2006 did the same thing. American Express Bank International in 2007. Union Bank of California, 2007. Lloyds Bank in 2009, Credit Suisse in 2011, UBS in 2009, Deutsche Bank in 2010, Credit Suisse in 2009, AMB Ambro in 2010, Barclays Bank in 2010. Each and every one of those banks that I just mentioned entered into what is called a deferred prosecution with the U.S. government. And in my mind, a deferred prosecution is legal speak for a slap on the wrist. A deferred prosecution means we have brought a criminal offense against you in an indictment or an information. we are agreeing with you. The bank says, I agree, yeah, we did commit that that criminal offense. And the bank says, well, and the government says, well, okay, now for the next 12 months, you need to demonstrate to us that you're not going to do that nasty behavior anymore. And at the end of that 12 months, if you do that, we're going to dismiss the indictment. And you're also going to have to pay a fine. And so the fines have ranged from anywhere from $750 million, down to the tens of millions of dollars. But each one of those institutions paid those fines. The interesting thing to me is that other than one of the banks that I mentioned, other than two of the banks that I mentioned, no individuals were ever held criminally responsible for the conduct of the bank. And in one instance, in UBS's instance, the only person who's gone to jail is the whistleblower who brought the information forward to the U.S. government to make him aware of the criminal conduct at UBS. So I just don't find that to be a very balanced administration of justice.
Okay, now this is, I know my audience is just sitting there chomping at the bit. Get them, Ernie, get them. They're freaking out because everything that you're talking about is a product of some kind of prohibition against moving pieces of paper. And I'm it's like regulating, I don't know, commodities, silver, a nail, hammers. I mean, you know, it's
some
just,
of it is terrorism. I don't know how you put it in that category.
Okay, terrorism based on?
Terrorism based upon an attack on the soil of the United States.
So when you have a crime like that, you prosecute the crime. And my thing is that we had this discussion before, and I want to when you talk about criminal activity, I want to make sure that we're, you know, talking apples and apples here, because being an infiltrator inside the dirty banks behind one of the big drug cartels gave you certainly, I would hope, a perspective and your experience of what you just described is that when they are caught, they just want to get their cut. Government's just a gang with a flag. They're just like, hey, man, where was our cut? Okay, here's your cut. Okay, we're done.
I agree.
So I'm going, all right, so how's that working out? Then you have the largest corporations doing it. What happens when you talk about the smaller banks, your local banks, complying with all this know your customer, you know, and you called it the Secrecy Act or something? What, you started off with
that? That's the actual law itself is identified as the Bank Secrecy Act.
Okay. Bank secrecy. Now, is the bank secret or the people secret, or is it just government speak for it's always opposite of whatever they say it is?
I think that's just a label. You know, you call an orange because you and I recognize it as orange. They could have called it the Bank Non-Secrecy Act, as far as I'm concerned. There's certain things that need to be done under the statute, and that's really what the meat is all about.
Okay, so here we have the local bank where regular Americans are, you know, the 99% of us that are banking with any institution, we are the ones that are complying with the law, the big, the bad.
You mean the banks are complying with the law because there's no legal requirement imposed upon you as an account holder.
There's a legal requirement. I want to use the bank. I want to get my money. I want to transfer my money. I want to wire my money that I do it, or I don't get to wire my money.
Sure, you can do that, and it's all legal. And these laws don't relate to you as an account holder. They relate to the bank and the bank's responsibility to
do
report
what?
Certain types of transactions.
To do what?
To report transactions.
From who?
By the individuals who conducted them, but that doesn't make the transaction illegal. There's nothing wrong with that.
Okay. I am being surveilled. My transactions are being logged, categorized, sent, tracked, whatever, true or false.
Depending upon the type of transaction, yes.
I pull out money to go buy my daughter a car. You know, I get $6,700 to get her a nice little car cap. Boom, man, you're on the list. I'm tracked. Where'd it go? Give me your fingerprints, right?
I don't know. No, I don't know of any requirement for fingerprints or for tracking that type of a transaction.
Okay, well, tell me what is tracked.
Any type of a currency transaction that's over $10,000 in either way across the teller line. So if you came in with $11,000 in cash, the law requires the bank to fill out a currency transaction report.
Okay, now, from personal experience, I have done this with less than $10,000. And you'll say, well, what's the criteria? Well, we're not allowed to tell you what the criteria is. because it could be structuring. You could be doing it more than once, or maybe going the next time. You know, so, you know, don't tell me it doesn't happen, because it's happened to me.
Well, the law is that if you structure transactions, that is, if you have multiple transactions on a given day that cumulatively exceed $10,000, yes, under those circumstances, if it's currency, the currency transaction report is filed.
So my point is that as individuals that aren't drug dealers, that are dealing, you know, and, you know, $10,000 isn't nothing anymore. I mean, you know, you're going out doing anything. Heck, I just spent a bunch buying silver. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I'm going, all right, because it went down below 30. I say, yes, and boss, I want some mo. Now, so I'm looking at an opportunity here to try and see it through your eyes. Mm-hmm. And we have a transaction that I'm doing with the bank, and I'm being all tracked and everything, or, you know, whatever the criteria is, know your customer for whatever reason.
Then well, we have the reason of making sure that you identify those who are likely to be involved in illegal activity,
which we're talking at hundreds of millions of dollars. This happens. And what happens when you have the real transactions between real criminals that are really doing bad things? Smack on the wrist. Give me a fine, a small itty bitty baby percentage of whatever profits there was. And then we're done. But in that atmosphere, I, as a little old peon nobody down here, still have to deal with it. And the real net effect of all these laws is a slap on the wrist to the real bad guys, true or false?
False. Okay. It is at times a deferred prosecution, as I described in those 10 bank cases. There are other cases that have been brought against individuals who are involved in either high levels of involvement in narcotics trafficking, terrorism, other types of illegal activity, who have gotten significant sentences as a result of violations of the laws that you were just speaking about. I take great exception to the government's decision to impose a fine on a financial institution that does something like what Wachovia Bank did in March of 2010. And that is to have solicited $400 billion in deposits during 2004 through 2007 from account holders in Mexico, and to provide to them, among other services, the physical transportation of bulk currency from Mexico back into the United States. And I say back because, in my view, that money was earned on the streets of the U.S. From drug trafficking for the most part. And to bring that money back, take it to a counting house, count it out, and turn it into a bank balance for account holders that you have every reason to believe are involved in the highest levels of drug trafficking.
Does this surprise you, though?
Yeah, it disgusts me.
Why?
Why?
Yeah, no, I mean, why does it surprise? Why is this? Because it's a law, or because, I mean, I tell you what, the banks are in the business of doing, especially as times get rough. They're, you know, we're into making some money. You know, and that's and it's going to happen. If it's not the banks, it's going to be somewhere else. It's going to get laundered through shopping malls. It's going to be casinos. It's going to be something. I mean,
well, there'll certainly be continued efforts. But, you know, I was an undercover agent. I was on my own. I didn't carry a badge or a gun, and I rarely had a cover team. I had millions, tens of millions of dollars at my disposal. I wouldn't have taken a dime of that money. And to think that your moral compass is based upon profits, to me, I'm sorry, it's a difficult thing for me to be able to figure out how anybody can rationalize laundering, purposefully laundering money for drug organizations that are throwing poison all over the streets of the United States.
Okay, this is where you and I always diverge a little bit, and so that we can understand that we're talking apples and apples here.
Okay.
In my philosophy, and I have four children, two grandchildren, a third on the way. I mean, you know, I'm not an isolated hermit individual out there in some utopian whatever in my own head. You know, I just imagine that I prefer to have a safe, healthy environment for my expanding family. I personally truly believe that they are safer, more prosperous, and a better environment where you don't have a central plan, an authority somewhere making laws saying what I can or cannot do with my property or my body or my money or my liberty, mine. When they start doing that, It is guaranteed every single time, not some of the time, most of the time, every time that you create a black market with prohibitions of anything. And the worst sort of people are profiting from that prohibition and from someone inside like you were. I can't imagine that you didn't see it on the corruption of U.S. officials, law enforcement, the banking industry, the regulators, the Department of Justice. I mean, it is a corrosive thing that permeates society based on a single concept that some people think they can tell what other people to do with their property or their body. And it manifests itself in all kinds of ways, including little stacks of paper or big stack, pallets of paper. And I'm just going, this is to think that you're in a... Now, I can see from your book and your experience that you can offer yourself as a consultant and be of value to corporations that in this current environment, they would choose not to run afoul of. They'd like to be able to say, hey, man, we did our due diligence and we had, you know, Robert Mazur come in and he hooked us up, explained it to us, and we kept ourselves out of trouble. But the big, giant, making money, bad BCCI crowd and Wells Fargo, Bank, name them, you know, they know. Heck, half the time, the reason they get with a slap on their wrist is it was some government agency that was profiting from it anyway. And there's always the drug dealers want the prohibition. That's how they make their money. I mean, we just go back to alcohol prohibition, the same freaking thing, the same way. Hell, it's the same families. So I'm just going, all right, so law enforcement benefits too. So I'm just, for you to be surprised by this is interesting, but I'm looking at, what is your moral compass that you're talking about? Is it because it's a law, because drugs need to be eradicated and the government needs to do it? I'm wondering where your moral compass is.
Well, to address some of the things you were talking about of regulating the access to things that the government calls illegal, you seem to feel as though that if there was no prohibition on crack cocaine, methamphetamine, and all those other drugs, that there would be a less presence of it, there would be less money generated by it, by bad people. I don't share that view, and I offer that you look at the instance of OxyContin, oxycodone, a legal drug, which you can...
No,
obtain.
It's not. It's regulated all the heck.
Oh, yeah, it's regulated.
It's got its own black market because of the regulation.
Well, okay. That's your view. So, but I don't share that view, and I just do believe...
No, but why? I understand you represent a lot of people. Heck, maybe even... Well, maybe not the majority anymore, but still a lot of people. You know, here we have, whenever you have an initiative to decriminalize drugs anywhere, it's like 70-80%, you know, so people know this drug war thing's done. You know, heck, we got two presidential Republican candidates on stage saying do away with the drug war. So I don't mean just marijuana, I mean getting rid of the drug war. And this is a paradigm that's shifting. So I have to ask you, someone in your position that saw the worst of it, and like you say, man, this funds terrorism. It may very well. You know,
it absolutely unequivocally does.
Yeah, it's called the CIA. So I'm going, you know, so the thing is I'm going, you know, you pick your poison and who's doing it. You know, the U.S. government to say that they don't benefit from this, if not indirectly, die freaking reckly. Here I am on YouTube. Here you go. Hello, CIA. Don't think I don't know you make money on this. Okay. This is not like, you know, kind of made it up. It's documented. You know, heck, you guys admit to it. So I'm going.
I haven't seen any solid proof that says that the CIA is purposely...
Well, you know what? I'm willing to bet some money.
Drugs.
Okay. You know, the reason we, right before the conversation, we started our conversation, 5 minutes before, I'm on the phone 15, 20 minutes with Sheriff Arpaio here in Maricopa County. Mm-hmm. Now, Sheriff Arpaio was DEA, and he was heading, you know, before, when he retired, he came sheriff here back in 92. I mean, that was a long time ago. And he and I have a relationship back. He knows that I know. He knows I know. He knows I know. I mean, this is, you know, I mean, please. When he first came here, the first thing as sheriff, he goes, we're going to put a bubble over Maricopa County, and every freaking car going in and out of the county is going to be searched for drugs. We're going to stop drugs. And that got beaten back by a county attorney and everything. And he's always, and we got a big you know, chalk the police event thing that's going on down at the county jail tomorrow, and that's going to be a woohoo and press deal and so on. We're working to make sure nobody dies. But the point is that he's all about the theater of this thing, but he knows. He knows what the drug war does. He knows how corrosive it is. I mean, he freaking knows. I ain't going into details, but he knows. So I'm going, all right, where's the benefit in this? How does this benefit society? Where do we really need this largest percentage, certainly enormous incarceration of Americans around this issue? And I have to ask, you know, from him, he doesn't even pretend that it's like, you know, it's going to solve anything. But I have to ask you, I mean, is this necessary? We're just not doing enough enforcement? We need to lock more people up?
Absolutely not. You know, my position on that is that we need to be doing more with respect to education and treatment. I do believe that the majority of our prison population are sick people who are in jail because they were involved in the lower levels of drug trafficking. I think that they get targeted oftentimes, unfortunately, because Congress decides that they're going to measure the efficiency of an agency based upon the number of arrests and the number of seizures that are made.
And how much money they get in RICO, and how much money the prison industrial complex makes, and how much...
If I could just finish what I was going to say, I'd appreciate it. I'm trying. What I'm saying is that those people wind up getting targeted, unfortunately, because Congress does not take the time to look behind the numbers, and the agencies, some people, do the something terrible that they shouldn't do, which is, how do we get the numbers up? And they wind up going after the little guys, and the bigger guys and the resources don't get on it. And I'm not saying that they do that across the board, because there are some very, very important cases that are made all over the globe by a small percentage of those who are involved in this war on drugs. That should be the norm. That shouldn't be the exception. And I couldn't agree with you more that our prisons are not filled to capacity with the people who are really the worst of the worst who are involved in that.
Yeah, they get the wrist slap. They're the ones that, you know, get a fine. They get a little bit of seizure.
Don't even get seen, because the amount of resources that it takes to try to take them on isn't something that we apparently have the stomach to want to do, which we should.
There is no amount of resources. That's my point. You are never going to go up against an army. Look what's happening in Mexico right now. The best thing that ever happened to Mexico would be if they decriminalized drugs. And that's a very serious issue right now. They have an entire campaign. It's coming from the people there. We've been talking to people. It's no more blood. You know, we're done. You know, in the drug war, it's mothers. By the tens of thousands of people that are slaughtered in mass graves over this drug war, at some point, you start to get that, you know what? I think it's not working. When is it?
I agree that there's too much put on the supply side, not enough put on education, and not enough put on treatment. But I don't believe that you can completely ignore the individuals who are the masterminds behind some of these huge organizations.
Of course they get ignored.
Prosecuted.
Of course they get ignored. They got the money. Heck, who do you think it is that is the most adamant about not ending the drug war? The drug dealers. Their whole livelihood evaporates. All this profit for terrorism they're talking about. Buy, you know, an ounce of marijuana, fund terrorism. I go, are you freaking kidding me? You know, make it illegal, you fund terrorism. You know, this is so stupid, and what's happening is that you're seeing it on the podium in a GOP Republican debate. Two presidential candidates up there saying, stop it.
Have they said that they thought that it would be a wise thing to legalize methamphetamine and crack cocaine?
Hell, Ron Paul was talking heroin. Isn't that good enough for you?
Who's the second candidate who recommended
New Mexico
that?
Gary Johnson. Gary Johnson came to Arizona.
Presidential candidate?
Yeah. On the debate, yeah, up there in the podium, man. Legalized drugs. This is way more than you think. When Governor Johnson came to Arizona, early 2000. I think it was about 2000. And I remember a reporter called me at my restaurant, and he says, Ernie, man, Gary Johnson... On the Senate floor, or the House floor in Arizona, they came, the border states, Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, California, came to Arizona to do a big thing about immigration. And Gary Johnson, as governor of New Mexico, said, You know what? You want to solve a bunch of this violence problem, that decriminalize drugs. Boom, done. And, oh, that made a big deal out. Now he's running for president, and Dr. Paul's doing his thing. So this is an entire generation next. These young kids, you know, heck, they're not even young anymore. They're getting in their 30s. And I'm going, they already know. It's not like you got to convince them or you're going to change their mind or something. They know. They know it's easier for a junior high kid to go out and buy, you know, drugs than it is to go get a beer. You know, this is, we know the truth. We know the truth. And there's nothing you can say that's going to change this other than coming out and saying we need more rigorous enforcement of the big bad guys. They're the ones behind keeping it illegal so they can make the money. It's just, it's phenomenal to me, that especially someone that's been inside. And I can see the benefit of your book and your advocacy is to keep the banks and local and so on that need to protect themselves against the bad guy because they're not big enough. They're not the big bad guys that are laundering the money for the different agencies that are benefiting from it anyway. And that's a good question for you. As you're inside the Escobar cartel, there had to be information flowing to you of corrupt individuals in the United States government that were benefiting and or allowing this to happen.
Not necessarily allowing the drug money laundering to happen, but individuals who most definitely were hired by the bank because they were known to be influential political people and became somewhat, in the bank's mind, insurance policies, so that if they did get a problem, they'd have somebody to turn to in their corner that they were going to try to be able to get them out of their problem. I mean, the examples include the former Secretary of Defense, Clark Clifford, who was put in position as the president of a bank that was secretly owned by this foreign institution. There was Jimmy Carter, to whom they gave all kinds of contributions to his charitable organizations because they wanted to ingratiate themselves upon him. Andrew Young, Burt Lance. I found ties also to individuals very close to Richard Nixon. So I found ties to high-level political figures in other parts of the world. I mean, the guy who was my investment advisor at this bank was a Pakistani whose father was formerly the head of the ISI. And the ownership of the bank included a guy who was at one time the head of Saudi intelligence. So there was a definite involvement of political types and intelligence people in the intelligence community.
Robert, you got to help me out here. I mean, this is, think about the billions, heck, we may have been getting into trillions of dollars over, heck, not that long, you know, 10, 20 years.
$400 billion a year is probably a pretty good estimate.
So
$400 billion a year.
Trillions of dollars a year that are going to the worst sort of exactly the kind of people that you want to stop because of the drug war. I mean, you don't see that?
I don't see that the legalization of all illegal drugs across the board at the snap of a finger is a wise thing to do whatsoever.
Because
we haven't spent any money trying to, and I know you don't believe you came from a privileged life, but there are certain segments of this society that definitely need to be educated and treated more before we open the floodgates. That's my belief. If you're going to go that route, then have a plan, and have a plan that you can do in at least some type of a somewhat organized fashion.
Freedom's the answer. What's the question?
Excuse me?
Freedom is the answer. What is the question? It's real simple. More freedom always fixes it. Yeah, you're not going to, you know, I don't know how else to put everywhere that you've liberalized gun laws, you liberalize drug laws, you liberalize freedom in any way, you always get better results. Always. Every single time. But it depends on what you're measuring. If you're
where have we got an entire nation where we have legalized everything across the board and measured it and found that there was a substantial improvement in the problem?
I'm willing to try. It was called America in 1700s.
Well, it's a little bit different environment for the citizens.
I don't
of this
think
country,
so. I really don't see it that way.
Yeah,
I mean,
well,
you know,
family
things...
unit was a different thing back then.
Well, why do you think that is? It's all this entitlement and government interference and social and economic engineering that creates a dependent class that then is managed, that then is profiting from illicit activity that is determined by a government and a central plan from Washington. I mean, on and on. I'm going, whoa. And I'm telling you, I can see the shift. We've known this was going to happen for decades. And now we're just now seeing, over the last 4 or 5 years, the Generation Next, with their ability to communicate instantaneously, their ability to transfer knowledge from one mind to another right away and in any different language. Heck, Freedom's Phoenix is translated into 39 languages at the touch of a button. We communicate directly with Arab Spring. I mean, we all these young people, they just do it instantaneously. They know exactly what's going on. And you're talking about money. Well, they already are well on. We have a digital magazine that we do, Freedom's Phoenix E-Zine. And in their first edition, and I think the second one too, we did extensive articles on Bitcoin, to where you have this internet transaction of money. They are heavy into silver now. They're doing all these old silver dimes and quarters and so on, pre-65, 90% silver coin they trade amongst themselves. Well, it's not trackable. You have different websites, you know, Craigslist, eBay, whatever, or they have these different ones. They do they do drug transactions in the open on the internet using encrypted digital money. So this is, it's not, these guys are the ones that develop this kind of stuff. You're not going to stop them. You can't. It's not possible. So I'm going to think that you're going to economically and socially engineer, you know, ones and zeros and inside the heads of people based on a control structure, is not only is it impossible, it's detrimental to humanity. We have to be free to act in what we perceive to be our self-interest without violating the rights of another. And the whole purpose of government is to make sure that your actions with your freedom doesn't infringe on mine. And that's the whole reason government's there, is to make sure that your rights are protected. The second you get into all of these controls and measuring and tracking and surveillance and all, you know, that is much bigger problem than the drugs themselves, in my opinion. And from someone that's been inside it, I have to ask you, as you saw the drugs being done, and I'm sure you got poster children all over the place that, you know, are bad, but the profit incentive drives it down to the junior high. It drives it into the high schools and the public schools and so on, because there's profit. Instead of there being a court system, or, you know, heck, even if you tax it or something like that, which I'm not a fan of, but at least you can go to court and say, hey, this guy abused my child. This guy did what? I mean, you have this ability to use a free market remedy on this, but in an illicit drug trade, you can't. And disputes are settled with M16s on the street corners in northern Mexico. I mean, I'm just... I don't see how freedom isn't the answer to, God, just about every problem that you come up with. And from the inside, I have to see that you hope that you saw the coercive effect of the drug war itself outweighed the drug damage that the drugs actually did. Or did you see it the other way? The drugs were more damaging than the drug war.
I do believe the drugs are more damaging than the drug war. I'm sorry, but I also think that the people that I dealt with, and this plays right into what you're talking about as far as profits. But I mean, they could have otherwise been running a Fortune 500 company. We're not talking about people who are working on the internet to sell little tiny amounts of drugs here and there. That's not really what my issue is all about. I'm talking about people who possess so much money. And are involved, you know, are driven to be involved in so much criminal activity that they attempt to, and in fact do, buy the will of countries. They buy the will of the police, of
well, I know
military,
why.
Of, I know you feel it's because it's illegal to deal in drugs, but
because they can, and they can because they have the money, and they have the money because you've created a black market, and there's a black market because there's a drug war. And it brings out the worst sort. And I'm sure you elbowed along with the guys that, you know, they love their family and kids and everything, but they probably didn't hesitate too much to kill somebody if they needed to.
Well, the main client that I had wound up being hung by his feet, had his clothes stripped off him, and used a blowtorch to melt the skin off his body. So, these were not nice people.
No, and prophets draw exactly these types of people. And I see the future, Robert, and I'll tell you, it doesn't involve a continuation of this drug war. It can't.
Well, it better include education and treatment.
Well, that's what freedom does, man. If you're responsible for yourself, then I'm going to be paying for this guy's health care. I go, really? Why would I do that? I'm going to be paying for this guy's disability. He doesn't have a job and he's nagged under a bridge and I got to house and feed him. I go, really? Why? Not in a free society. You take responsibility for yourselves. I mean, you may charitably, oh my goodness, you might even, with less government, you might even have the money and ability and the time and the willingness to actually be charitable to someone in need. But now it's so... Our society is not anywhere near what it used to be. Heck, even I'm only 50 years old, and I look at my four children are 21 to 26, and I look at them, and I'm like, they have no idea what it was like before you had to be anal probed to get on an airplane. They don't even know. Heck, when I was in high school, you just get on the plane in a shuttle from Boston to Washington, D.C., and you paid on the plane with a credit card. I mean, so I'm just... this country has gone so far down the dark side, and I don't see more tracking, more surveillance, more, vigorous prosecution of the guys that you want to prosecute that, by the way, in your personal experience, don't get prosecuted.
Well, some do. There's no doubt about
that.
No,
they got to have an example.
As many as there should, and there's too much law enforcement focused on the little guys who are sick. And in that way, in some manner, there is some common ground, I think, in our thinking. I'm not suggesting that the way the war on drugs is being fought today is the way that it should be fought.
Well, how would you fight
across the board? I would not be working on I would not be putting people in prison for the rest of their lives who are involved in lower-level drug trafficking activity and got involved in it because they were a part of it as users and then got involved in trying to traffic in it because they were trying to feed their habits. Those are not the kind of people, in my view, who should be sitting in prisons for the rest of their lives. One of the reasons that I wound up leaving law enforcement when I did was what I thought was being witnessing a hypocrisy in the administration of justice. At the same time, we had the types of cases that I've talked to you about concerning these major banks and major drug organizations. I happened to be sitting in court one day, and two young men who were barely out of their teens, one's 20 and one the other was 21, they had sold enough crack cocaine that I could hold in my hands. It was their third offense. They went to prison for the rest of their lives. They are still in prison today. I can't figure out how that makes sense when we take the position that we do sometime with the types of international type cases, the international banking type cases that I'm talking about.
It's natural outgrowth of it.
Compare what they did to the $400 billion in deposits that was taken by Wachovia.
Well, I'll explain it to you. Here at Arizona State University, about 3 weeks ago, my partner in the Freedom Summit that we do every year, his name is Mark J. Victor. He's a criminal defense attorney. He's very well known here. He's always some high-profile case doing something. And it came up to where the Federalist Society, which is kind of an organization on ASU campus for I want to be a lawyer, okay? So they decide Mark Victor was a Federalist Society member. He went to law school there, as did, at the same place, Bill Montgomery, which is the Maricopa County attorney here. So he's a guy working hand-in-hand with Sheriff Arpaio. Now, Bill Montgomery is, he sounds a lot like you. I mean, he's one of those strict enforcement guys, go get him, we need drug war, and go get him.
I didn't say that, but go ahead.
Well, I mean, I would put, you're not one of us, let's put it that way.
That's true.
So we have, what happened was the Maricopa County, the state chairman of the Libertarian Party is an attorney, another one, and he was running against Bill Montgomery for county attorney. Well, what happened was the students there saw this debate on the drug war a little bit in some forum, and they said, "Hey, man, we got to have a big ASU thing. We'll invite and open up a big room. And we'll woohoo do it up." Well, Michael couldn't do it because he was running for office against Russell Pierce and so on. It's a long story. So he said, "Hey, well, we'll give it to Mark." Well, Mark has been begging for decades to do this. He's presented to the attorneys and judges and so on about the drug war. He goes, "Look, man, I make a crap load of money off the drug war. I guarantee I make more money than any of you guys do on this drug war." All right. So he goes up and finally it's agreed to. 2 weeks prep on this thing. We're making a woohoo big deal out of it. Fills up the room at Arizona State University, big auditorium room in there at the law college, Sandra Day O'Connor Law College there. And here comes the press, a bunch of people. We take the video and we put it up on YouTube. What happened was Bill Montgomery asked that, "Okay, I don't want it put on the YouTube. Don't put me up." So we just kind of did a little snippets of him going in and out, and then we had Mark's argument. What happened was, is he made the case with the county attorney sitting right there saying, no, the people in jail are not there for mere possession. They're not the users. They're not, we haven't filled up. Oh, that's a lie. They're, you know, no. But then, of course, he brings up things. Let me tell you how it really works. What happens in the real world when I am every day saturated with drug cases that clog up the courts, that are breaking us, that it is a farce of justice. So he sits there and he says, like what you're talking about, third time selling a joint, boom, life in prison. He had paraphernalia. No, you got two joints in your car. You don't get charged with possession. You get charged with trafficking, distribution, transportation, and a paper that's wrapped in paraphernalia. I mean, they just throw on so much crap. Why? Because it's social and economic engineering from the federal government in this drug war to entice. You get your car stolen, you scream to the police, "I see him, he's driving off." Well, we'll just give you some on the phone reports, you can turn it to your insurance, kind of whatever. But if you say you smelled marijuana or the guy was smoking dope or had a crack pipe in his pocket, the helicopters come out. So I'm going, this is so jacked up. And one of the points made, why are we spending so much time on this drug war when we got real violent people out there that is not a profit for the government or law enforcement or local municipalities to go after? It costs them money. They don't want to do that. They want to go after the pot smokers because they make more money at it and they can seize property and they don't have to go to trial on it. And they can do it. I'm going, you really, to make any case for this drug war, are going to have to pare it down to something. And I need you to tell me, okay, if we just limited it to What would be your good drug war?
I don't have a good drug war because it's not a good story. But what I would want, and I've said this before, and so, you know, I'm just repeating myself. I would not be putting resources toward people who are sick with education and treatment. I wouldn't be putting them behind bars and paying for them week after week, month after month, year after year, in a prison. And I would focus my attention more on those individuals involved globally in the war on drugs because of the nexus that clearly exists between them and terrorism. And you may want to try to change things with the snap of a finger, but you're not going to, in my view. And you're not going to be able, in my view, to be able to have a successful transition to that, what you're talking about doing, in an isolated cocoon where there is an inadequate amount of education and treatment available for the massive amount of individuals that exist in the United States with an insatiable appetite for illegal drugs. It's pervasive. And I just, if you want to work toward the goals you're talking about, I just don't understand how you can feel as though you could succeed in doing it by just changing things overnight.
We are succeeding.
Okay.
You know, see, the thing is, it's a culture thing. I know better. I'm an activist, man. I've been doing this for a long time. It's not, you know, like here in Arizona, you know, it's not a snap of the finger. All of a sudden, they're decriminalizing stuff. They're not, you know, all of a sudden, boom, any and everybody can carry concealed without a permit. Heck, that started with us back in 93. You know, the drug thing, same thing. I mean, this has been libertarian candidates and activism and people in the streets and what I was talking about with Sheriff Arpaio this morning about stuff we're doing down at his jail tomorrow. And then all of this is a cultural awareness. And the biggest thing, I'm talking to Sheriff Joe, I've known him for years, and I just said, look, man, I just want to make sure, one, nobody dies. You guys don't do anything stupid because it's going to be up on, you know, video live streaming in about 3 seconds. You know, I just want to make sure everybody's peaceful. Everybody understands what this is about is a culture change. It's a paradigm shift in the understanding of the truth. And that's what I advocate for, is people just to understand the truth of things when they do, you know, because you and I want the same thing. You know, I can't imagine that we want people to be, destitute, damaged, hurt, violent, going after somebody. Not that you smoke marijuana and any violence is done anywhere. But I mean, you know, I'm going, there is, you know, I'm a grandfather. But what if, you know, I mean, Robert, can you at least give me this, that you believe that I believe that my family would be safer, more prosperous, we'd have a freer society by not having any drug laws?
Well, there's no doubt that that's what you believe. I'm not challenging that. Obviously, you believe strongly in that regard. I know that.
So I'm looking for, you know, the reason I have conversations with this, I mean, there's value to your experience and what you've gone through and the book that you've written and the value you have, the different industries that need your expertise in order to be, you know, make sure they don't run afoul of having everything taken. My thing is just get the right lobbyists. But, you know, so that's why I have you on as a service to people that need to know this kind of stuff. I'm sure it's an interesting book. And let's go ahead and give that out again. We'll make sure, you know, we give you props here. The Infiltrator, My Secret Life Inside the Dirty Banks Behind Pablo Escobar's Medellin Cartel. Now they can go ahead and give out the website you want them to be most familiar with.
Sure. It's the-infiltrator.com. That's the-infiltrator.com. You know, and I'm not running for president, so I'm not putting ideas on how this problem can be resolved. My whole goal is to try to open the eyes of the people who are in this country about where the real problems are with respect to the massive amount of illegal drugs that are being moved around the world and the kind of money that it moves. What the resolution to that is, I know we have a differing opinion, but I think it's very, very important for people not to generalize, but to be able to know specifically, with specific story and accuracy, the history of what I had the opportunity to see firsthand. And to whatever regard that helps us toward a positive result, I'm just trying to be, you know, I'm trying to put a piece of the puzzle out there for people, because most people who hear the story aren't as informed as you, and don't get it and don't understand what type of big business the illegal drug trafficking is all around the globe.
Well, they may know, because your book may be made into a movie, Banking on Terror. Tell me about that.
Banking on Terror is an article that I wrote that was published, but there is an effort afoot to develop a movie from my book. So, and hopefully, it will be something that'll be seen more broadly than it is right now. It's a serious, serious problem. I do not embrace across the board by any means the tactics that are common in the war on drugs now. I just don't go as far as you do in how I think things could be done better.
Well, you know who does? I mean, you know, law enforcement against prohibition, I have Leap on a regular basis.
Oh, yeah. I ran into the guy, and actually I was doing a presentation in Cambridge University, and the heads of that organization were there observing. I've got their card, and I'm going to communicate with them, and I'm not afraid to talk to somebody, because we might have a difference of opinion, and I'm always willing to keep an open mind to hear other people's ideas, because I know that there are a lot of people out there that are smarter than me. So.
Well, these guys, you know, many of them are in your exact position. Maybe, heck, they may even been down the street with the Pablo's wing of whatever. You know, these are people that are narcotics officers, judges, you know, police chiefs. I mean, it's just phenomenal, the growing, you know, you're saying not making progress. Hell, you just look at that, you know. So I'm going, there is a wider understanding of what's really behind this drug war. The drug war is not. Do you think some congressman politician gives a rip about some junior high kid, you know, dying of OD on blah, blah, blah? They don't freaking care. They're out sending people to die for stupid crap all over the world. This is just a voting block thing. It's a money thing. It's a special interest thing. It has nothing to do with, you know, freedom or really fixing our society or stopping social and economic engineering to the point that we go, oh, by the way, we're broke, okay? This country done, dollar done. You know, so this is, we're trying to advocate for a society that doesn't repeat this cycle. And we have a chance. We have a chance because people are now able to communicate instantaneously with each other, and not only sharing information, but sharing wealth. You know, this Bitcoin thing is going to change everything. You don't have to, you know, abolish the Fed. You just have to be able to ignore them. And that's what's happening. And I'm going, so you're right. You know, a lot of people think that you're not going to see it, you know, happen, you know, overnight. And I'm like, nah, it always happens overnight. I mean, you may not be able to see it happen, but I'm saying, you know, it doesn't happen all at once. I mean, you can see it happening. You know, we see it now. You got to just flip on the news, go to Freedom's Phoenix. But one day you wake up one Monday morning and the entire world is different. Ask Greece, ask Iceland, ask Ireland, ask Europe, you know? So I'm going, and it's coming here. And
the organization you spoke about, is that Leap? Did you say it was Leap?
Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, right.
Yeah, okay, yeah. It was a board chair by the name of Jack Cole out of Massachusetts.
Yeah, no, I've had Jack on. Okay. These are, you know, there's a Judge Gray in Southern California also that he came and spoke at our Freedom Summit last year. And he's, you know, a judge, and you're starting to find a lot of judges and so on doing this. And what happens when we have these conversations? We went through this at Arizona State University with Mark and County Attorney Montgomery, and they are just, you know, I'm not wanting to put you in that category, but Bill, he'll get up and he'll advocate for we gotta, and he's like he's talking to 100 blue hair Republican widowed women, you know, and he's talking at ASU to a younger crowd that knows better. And he starts spouting off statistics and gateway drug stuff and all this other. And these kids are laughing. They don't understand how much information is out there. And the younger class with a Facebook account in 6 months, they know more about philosophy and actual statistics and data and arrest and money spent. Who made they in 6 months? They know more than these guys have learned in their entire lifetime that they're advocating for up on the stage. And if you've had experience at different events at Columbia University with LEAP guys over there, you could probably recall the reaction from the audience. They're not for this drug war anymore, man. It's not working.
Yeah, no, I know that's their message. There's no doubt about it.
Well, it's been always a pleasure to talk to you and have this discussion because I think it's beneficial to everybody to know that, you know, one, the book, The Infiltrator, you know, My Secret Life Inside the Dirty Banks Behind Pablo Escobar's Medellin Cartel, which is a long title, but, you know, you probably need it all. But the thing, how long were you inside?
I did two operations that totaled about 5 years. So I lived another life, basically, for about that length of time.
Well, you know, I tell you what's more surprising than anything is that you would, you know, do that and come out with the attitude that you can fix it. I mean, that's surprising right there, you know, but to see the injustice of the people that profit the most from it and then take the money and give it to the very people that we're having a war on terror against and all this other stuff, I can see how that just frosts your chaps, man.
It sure does.
So I understand. I just want to make sure that, you know, we kind of come, whether we think we're going the right path or you are or I am or what your opinion is of what we advocate and you know mine, but I think that we're looking for a peaceful, prosperous, safe future. It's just how best to do that.
I agree.
All right, well, that's what we're looking for. It's been a pleasure. Robert Mazur, The Infiltrator, My Secret Life Inside the Dirty Banks Behind Pablo Escobar's Medellin Cartel. It's going to be, you know, if it's not going to be a movie soon, it's going to be a movie someday, because damn, I mean, how often does that happen?
Freedom's the answer. What's the question? You're listening to Ernest Hancock.
I want to break free. I want to break free. I want to break free from your lies. Your
we want to break free here on Declare Your Independence, Part 2. Part 2 with Robert Mazur. You know, we were talking off air. We ended it. I'm going, no, heck no. We're going to be talking about this on the air. So this is another little addition to information for all of us here. And go ahead. And we'll start back with the conversation you're saying on who, when you're talking to people, one, who are you talking to? And what they say about who's the largest money launderer on the planet? So go ahead and tell us that. Robert Mazur, the infiltrator, My Secret Life, Inside the Dirty Banks, Behind Pablo Escobar's Medellin Cartel. So listen to this. This is good information you need to know. Go ahead.
Well, what I was mentioning to you is, I detailed this in my book, but there was I used to socialize with the dirty bankers and the drug traffickers, and because in order to manipulate their confidence, you can't just go in and do a transaction and leave. So this was an event that occurred. It's probably about, I don't know, in the early morning hours at a social club in Miami, and there in the conversation, and the person with whom I was speaking was a guy by the name of Akbar Bilgrami. Akbar Bilgrami was a very, very high-ranking officer within Bank of Credit and Commerce International in their Miami office. That's where they ran all of their Latin American division operations from. So everything that happened in South America or related to South America went through Miami. And as we were having a few drinks, he said, you know the biggest money launderer in the United States is? And, you know, being a typical agent, I was, you know, sitting at the end of my chair waiting to get this great information about a case I thought I'd be bringing back to the office. And he said, well, the biggest money launderer in this country is the Federal Reserve. And I said, how's that? And he said, well, you know about the sinister window, don't you? And I said, no, tell me more. And he said, well, right now it's totally legal at the Bank of the Republic in Colombia, who, of course, has all the central banks around the world have account relationships with the Federal Reserve for the dollars that they deal in. So what he was saying is that the central bank in Colombia had this window and invited the heavy hitters to bring as much U.S. dollars as they wanted to the Bank of the Republic, and they could anonymously exchange it for Colombian pesos. But thereafter, those dollars, and we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars and over a period of time billions of dollars, being put on pallets, shrink-wrapped, and flown out of Colombia and brought to the United States and taken to the Federal Reserve, where it is turned into a bank balance on behalf of the Bank of the Republic. And as Mr. Bilgrami said to me, don't you think there's somebody at the Federal Reserve with enough common sense to sit back and go, why are we getting billions of U.S. dollars from the Central Bank of Colombia? It doesn't make any sense. Well, the most obviously, drugs are sold for cash. You don't sell drugs for credit card balances. And that's really where all that money was coming from. And it wouldn't have taken a rocket scientist, and most certainly there had to be someone there who would have seen this huge blip on the radar screen of all this currency coming in. Now, that became such a politically hot issue that in the early 1990s, about 1992 or 1993, the central bank in Colombia shut that window down. But if your listeners just go to, go Google sinister window, Colombia money laundering, they'll eventually come across the references to the sinister window that used to exist.
Okay, so why did they shut it down? I mean, at first it's open, the Federal Reserve knows. The U.S. government knows. Central Intelligence, FBDEA, blah, 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 they all know. The alphabet soup up. The United States federal freaking government, no. Department of Justice, no. Everybody knows. Everybody knows. So they shut it down. Why?
Well, I think they shut down the sinister window because it's politically impossible to justify having that window. That doesn't change the fact that there's a large amount of U.S. dollars that come back from many central banks, including the central bank in Colombia, but the actual sinister window itself was shut down. If you look at today's activity, another thing your readers can go to see this, HSBC Bank, Hong Kong Shanghai Bank Corporation, is presently the subject of a criminal investigation in New York, a federal grand jury investigation. And the heart of that investigation has to do with the fact that that HSBC office in New York is alleged to have been repatriating somewhere around $8 or $9 billion a year from Mexico on a continuous basis. The banking business, the international banking business, has a revenue stream that comes from buying and selling bulk currency. I have seen records and can tell you that on a $40 billion gross of dealing in currencies, there are international banks that have made as much as 10%, $4 billion, on the profits. But where do you think the money is coming from when you're bringing in $40 billion or from some of these countries, which have a high profile for being havens for major drug organizations?
It's so black market, fill in the blank. It could be white slavery, prostitution, drugs, kiddie porn, whatever. It's whatever you make illegal, man, you make a profit.
Well, you don't have to go back to 1993 to see that kind of movement of bulk currency around the globe. It's happening now, and we'll be hearing soon. The rumors are, and I've seen some articles that have been appearing recently, that grand jury investigation out of HSBC is allegedly coming to a head, and some of the predictions are a fine of $1 billion.
Big deal.
Yeah, that's what I say, big deal. That's the cost of doing business.
Yeah, you know, they just factor that in. Heck, they're probably lucky it's only $1 billion.
And the only way you're going to change that, and I know you don't agree with this, but in my view, the only way you're going to change that kind of behavior is to start locking up some high-ranking bank people who think that they are much smarter than the rest of the world.
Like who? Ben Bernanke? I mean, you know...
I don't care. I'd go in and find out right now who... I think, and hopefully the government has, found out who it is that put together the business deal to bring in tens of billions of dollars from places like Mexico. And it wouldn't be very difficult. It wouldn't be very difficult to be able to substantiate that the individuals who did that did it knowing full well that they were bringing dirty money back into the United States. And I think that as of right now, as long as the law exists, I'd rather see the resources of law enforcement applied toward that than the two guys at age 20 and 21 who sold enough crack for me to hold in two hands and wound up going to prison for life. That's my biggest complaint. I just think it's a total imbalance.
You know, it's stories exactly like that that have increased the population of LEAP. I mean, it's that kind of injustice. It's that kind of just insanity that these guys go, man, and it's never too late. I mean, a lot of these, I'll tell you one story. I just interviewed a guy. You'd like this one. His grandfather started the Native American church, you know, to try and maintain, you know, back in mid-1800s, maintain the spiritual aspect of Native Americans, blah, blah, blah. And it went through a lot of different court cases and them and recognized and all that kind of stuff. And there was a recent Utah Supreme Court decision. And Utah Supreme Court, you would think a little bit more about religious freedom, you know, in light of the Mormon thing there and so on. And what they did is they said, look, as long as you're using some naturally grown herb, peyote, marijuana, or any whatever, you know, cocoa leaf, whatever, in some kind of religious sacrament, boom, you're on your own. It's all good. Here's your card. So all of a sudden, you'll see on Freedom's Phoenix, they started advertising on Freedom's Phoenix. You join their church for, I don't know, what is it, $100, $200 or whatever it is. I'm a member of your church, and I'd be smoking my sacrament. So I'm going, you know, this is the kind, and the guy doing that now was a undercover narc. And he's with LEAP, and he knows how detrimental, and he went back to his roots, Native American kind of whatever, and he's like, it's amazing the number of people in LEAP that have, from your experiences just like yours, that he was telling me stories of how many people he put away forever and young kids and this, and it just gets to a point to where they, to rationalize all the effort that you put in to your book and who the bad guys really are and what this funds and everything. It has to eat at you that these young kids in jail for the rest of their lives, while this injustice is done to the guys that profited from it, get a slap on the wrist. But it is expected. That's what happens all the time. So I'm, you know, talk to these guys. I'm sure they share a lot of the experiences that you have. I've heard a lot of their stories, and I'm just like dumbfounded, man. I'm like, How were you able to go through the mental gymnastics? I learned a new word, cognitive dissonance. You know, I keep hearing that all the time. I had no idea what they were talking about. So I look it up and so on. And it's like holding two competing, diametrically opposed ideas or principles in your head. You know, it's like trying to do mental gymnastics to rationalize both things. We have to prosecute the drug war, but we don't want to have these kind of things happen. And I'm going, sooner or later, one's going to have to win out. You know, sooner or you're just going to go crazy. You're going to have to go, look, man, we got, you know, freedom's the answer. What's the question? Or it's going to be, all right, we just got to, you break the law and we got a law, go get the law, which is kind of what you're doing with, but you want to go after the higher, more profile people profiting from this. And I'm telling you, with the story that you just said about the Federal Reserve, of course they know it's coming from drug money. Of course. Of course. But who are you going to tell? Who's going to prosecute them? Who's going to go, hey, man, it's not a law. And guess what? They make sure it doesn't become a law neither. So it's just another example of you're not going to fix this.
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right about the mental torture people who've been through some of the types of experiences that, and not just me. I mean, there's lots of people who are out there, and some of them are in LEAP, and some of them aren't. But it is a very, very difficult thing to struggle with.
Yeah, I've heard this before. A lot of these kinds of stories, and people go different ways. It took them longer time. They went different paths, and blah 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 blah. But you know, at the very least, I think you find some peace just talking to these people because they're you. I mean, I've talked, they've gone through these kinds. They've been deep undercover doing all kinds of stuff, and it just gets to the point. You know, I remember Sheriff Richard Mack. You know, he was a sheriff here in Graham County in southeastern Arizona before he went on to do, you know, a lot of those stuff. He's the power of the sheriff and all the stuff that he advocates for. And we became friends in the mid-90s. And he was a Spanish-speaking undercover narc officer. And that's how he, you know, started in this. You know, I think his father was FBI. And it just, to hear the stories, and you just have to come, because everybody wants to do the right thing. You know, our legal system is set up in a certain way. This is illegal. And then you start to find out how it really works. And who really benefits. And who really gets prosecuted. And who really gets to profit. And who really suffers. And you just got to go. And so from us, it's easier for me to look at this and say it's just an example of another version of social and economic engineering and getting government outside of the box that the Constitution was to put them in. And that's why Dr. Paul's being so popular, is that it's because, like, freedom is popular. The whole purpose of government was defense of individual rights, not to run lives, not to get inside, do all this kind of stuff. So even the profits from if you eliminated all of the prohibition incentive for the money, well, a lot of this stuff would just go away. But I'm sure there is, you know, ill-gotten gains from something. You stole somebody's property, you stole, and then that money, and then you track. But I'm going, you know, that doesn't really work either by making all of us suspects. You know, so I'm just, you know, you prosecute force and fraud, and a lot of the stuff just goes away. And you have a much better society for my grandkids, which is why I work so hard for this. There's not like big giant money, you know, and advocating for freedom. I mean, you don't got a special interest for that other than just people that support you. And oftentimes, even wealthy people, they want to be free just as much too. So I really appreciate you spending a little extra time with us on that, because I find that fascinating that we got, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars, you know, over time, just coming into the U.S. in pallets into the Federal Reserve, and they got a nice grease skid for it to happen.
Yeah, it goes on every day, and it's going on every day now.
Oh, let me see. Is there a doubt in my mind? No.
Yeah.
All right, Robert. Well, it looks like you might be making some new friends. I encourage that. I think it'd give you some peace. I mean, I'm all about, you know, just, you know, taking the cloud off of my head, the weight off of my shoulders, and at the very least they would you know, be able to just share some stories. I think it'd be interesting them to get your perspective too. So
yeah.
And I look forward to the movie, because, you know, being inside the Escobar cartel for years is like, damn. And the fact that you're able to maintain your position on this the way you are is That's interesting too. Why do you think that is? I mean, what's your upbringing? You know, as a mother, father, white picket fence, went to church every Sunday. I mean, what do you think?
I grew up in New York in on Staten Island, which is the smallest of the five boroughs. My mom and my dad was raised primarily in New Jersey. His father came from Poland and wound up getting land and becoming a farmer. And my mom came from a side of the family who was all Italian. And as I mentioned in my book, my grandfather, among other things, worked in a group with a moving company that was actually moving booze for Lucky Luciano. So he knew what Prohibition was all about. But I think that one of the reasons that I probably got through the undercover schools and the psychological profiling and got sanctioned to do this kind of stuff, because it's very, very unusual. It puts you in a pressure cooker mentally. It is the most difficult task mentally and physically that I can ever imagine someone would go through. You need to be the type of person who is very firm in their convictions. It is very easy, once you are in the underworld, to begin to sympathize with them, to begin to lose your foundation. And if you have people whose very character isn't strong on that, you don't have a very vivid idea of right and wrong, black and white, if you've got a lot of grays in there, you probably are going to be at greater risk working long-term undercover than a person who's not. But my dad worked three jobs at a time because his dream was to be able to put his two sons through college, and that's what happened. And we were the first two in our family to graduate from college, which my parents were very proud about. And that's really what my...
What decade did you graduate college?
I graduated college in 1972.
So you can... Yeah, see, it's so interesting to have... It's a generational thing that you start to realize that people are a product of their environment and their upbringing and all this kind of stuff. And it's... you never get an expansion of government or respect my authority and everything on the idea that you're going to do somebody harm. You know, it's always on the promise that you're going to make things better, that we're going to, you know, and that's how we're suckered in. But over time, and certainly with the ability to communicate with the internet and, you know, have access to a lot of information, it's getting to the point to where we're starting to understand that the world that you were brought up in doesn't exist anymore. True. And the reason it doesn't exist anymore is because a lot of these, you know, promises that government made. And I'm going, you know, government doesn't work, man. I want my money back. You know, I'm convinced it's, you know, I'm done. I mean, if you're not going to go back to the base foundational understanding of what government was back when you were in school, all the problems that we have now are a product of the drug war that was announced by Nixon at the time that you were graduating college. So I'm just... And I can see how, all right, it's announced drug war, I'm out of here, we're going down part of, and we're going to go kick some butt, and I got an American flag to, you know, put in my wallet. And I understand that, and you can't blame people for being, you know, part of a generation that they spent billions, if not trillions of dollars in the public education, and in the propaganda, and the corporate media, and all this to put us into a certain mindset to believe certain things. But it was always challenged by those little bitty baby percentages of these Thomas Jefferson-type libertarian Bastiat, you know, Rothbardian freaking libertarian guys out there going, yeah, we know where this is going. This is going to go bad. So the same thing at the same time. It's 71. We go off the gold standard. They start to see what the Fed allows the Federal Reserve to do this kind of stuff. And you go, here comes Ron Paul, runs for Congress, goes through, has been saying for 30-something years, here we go. This is going to happen. This is why. Then it happens, he's 75, 76 years old, and his biggest supporters comes from people under 30. And you go, and man, what kind of world are we living in? And it's not understandable to a lot of people, certainly from your generation and with your experiences. But as time goes on, all of a sudden it starts to make sense. You were being duped, man. You were a cog in the machine to support something that they knew back then they were profiting from. Air America out of the CIA and Vietnam at the same time. Heck yeah, we need a war on drugs, more profit. You know, so I'm just, this is just craziness. And I'm starting to see the break. And it's really coming from direction that you wouldn't expect. And it takes someone and people like you to come out with the information. It just has, regardless of your position, it's just more information. And you can see every word that you say and every story that you have just reinforces, you know, what I'm looking at anyway. So I'm just thinking that we're not in a confrontation, that we're yelling at each other and we're not, you know, we're going to some different direction. We're going to the same place. It's just how to get there. And I'm glad you're able and willing to come on my show and we get to share this, have this conversation, and we all learn something, because I'm looking forward to the movie. I'll promote the crap out of the movie when they do it, and we'll talk about it again, and everybody will go watch it.
Yeah, well, and I too, I really do appreciate sharing ideas, and I'm not closed-minded on how to get to the same place I think we both feel and we both believe this country should be all about. We just happen to have a different view right now on how to get there, but hopefully between the combination of your ideas and mine and ideas of others who are willing to open their voice, you know, maybe change can happen. And,
well, I'm for going after the same bad guys you are, because I know they're the ones making sure this is going on anyway. Hey, thanks for spending time with me and doing a little extra there, because I think that was a fascinating story. I want to make sure it got in there.
Okay, thank you. I really
Robert
Mazur.
Mazur, the-infiltrator.com is book, The Infiltrator, My Secret Life Inside the Dirty Banks Behind Pablo Escobar's Medellin Cartel. Wow, man, fascinating stuff. We'll talk to you next time. And it's the-infiltrator.com. The-infiltrator.com. Robert Mazur. Robert, thanks for coming on. It's always a pleasure.
Well, thank you very much.
You bet.
I appreciate it.
We'll talk to you next time here on Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock. Check out freedomsphoenix.com for all of the daily news.